Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show, we will be talking about sustainable energy and its place in the energy mix here in the United States. When President Bush unveiled his energy plan, about a month ago, some people were critical because of its continued reliance on fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, and the fact that so little importance was put on the potential for renewable sources of energy, things like solar and wind and biomass and so forth. So this morning, we thought we'd spend some time talking about where we stand with these kinds of energy sources, what we're doing to try, and as a country, as a matter of policy, what we're doing to try to develop them and the potential that they have for supplying some of our energy needs. And we'll be talking this morning with a fellow who's been involved in the energy field, on a policy level for quite a number of years now. His name is Dan Riker. He is currently a visiting fellow at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. Before that, he worked in the U.S. Department of Energy for a number of years. From 1997 until this year, he was the Assistant Secretary of Energy for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the Department of Energy. And before that, he had other posts as well. Before that, he was a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He also served as a staff member of President Carter's Commission on the Accident at Three Mile Island and as Massachusetts Assistant Attorney General for Environmental Protection. He's talking with us by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. Anyone who's listening, if you want to call in, make a comment, ask a question, that's certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. Anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you are listening, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere, the signal will travel through the air, over the internet, you can call in. And the toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Riker, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thank you for talking with us.
Good to be with you, David.
I am assuming that you at this organization that you're associated with would be among those who would fault the Bush administration for not in their energy planning and proposals for not giving more attention to renewables.
Yeah, I was concerned about the president's plan issued about a month ago. It lacked the kind of balance that I think we need in this country between supply and demand. Not enough stress on efficient ways to use energy and not enough stress on cleaner approaches to producing energy in the first place. Yeah. We need a good diversity of sources in this country, but it didn't give the kind of emphasis that I think is important to renewable energy sources, which ultimately I think not only from someone coming from government, but many energy companies as well believe that's the long-term answer to a good chunk of our energy challenge.
Well, let me ask you this, and I think that some people would also have some criticism for the Clinton administration. They would say that that administration, that they would have reason to be disappointed with its energy policy. They might even go as far as to say there wasn't much of an energy policy, and that the Clinton administration also didn't do very much to try to promote renewable sources for all of its talking about that being important. Now, here you were, this was the position that you were in during that administration. I expect you'd want to say, well, in fact, the administration was active in that field. What do you think was accomplished, or was anything accomplished?
Well, let me tell you, there has been this sort of drumbeat I've heard that the Clinton administration didn't have an energy plan. In fact, if you base the existence of an energy plan on a document like the Bush administration issued a month ago, we actually put out two energy plans during the Clinton administration. They, I think, advocated quite a balanced approach. One of them was, in fact, called a sustainable energy strategy. But much more than the document itself, the words on paper, is what we advocated both nationally and internationally. As a part of this plan, we went to Capitol Hill and we said we need to provide greater funding to develop renewable energy sources, increase the R&D spending on the federal side, match it with industry money, and we're going to be able to accelerate wind, solar, biomass, geothermal, hydrogen, fuel cells, all sorts of things much more rapidly. Unfortunately, the Congress turned down those requests. And when the Bush administration took over, they actually made dramatic cuts to that R&D funding, or at least have proposed major cuts. Hopefully Congress will resist those. Secondly, the Clinton administration went to Capitol Hill and said, one of the ways you can help move relatively immature technologies into the market is with tax credits. And we proposed a very broad-ranging set of tax credits for both renewable energy and energy efficiency. And again, virtually all of those were turned down by the Congress. We proposed some federal legislation that would have much more rapidly moved the country towards the use of renewables by setting a national standard for the use of renewable energy. We would have reached a percentage of our electricity by 2010 from renewables that would have been about triple of what it is today. And we, of course, advocated internationally for a resolution or at least some initial steps to address climate change. And in addressing climate change, one immediately gets, obviously, to cleaner energy technologies. So I think we have a pretty good record from the Clinton administration. Unfortunately, we had a Congress that resisted virtually everything we proposed.
What role now in the energy mix in this country do renewables play?
Well, there's a couple ways to look at it, and I will not shower you with too many statistics, but if you look at how we make electricity in this country today, about 2-3% of our electricity comes from solar, wind, geothermal energy, that's energy from heat in the earth, and from biomass, from organic materials that we burn or we turn into ethanol and do other things with. About 8-9% beyond that comes from hydropower, another source of renewable energy. So that's on the electricity side. If you look at the larger beyond electricity, all the inputs into the U.S. economy for energy, one interesting statistic is that about 3% today already comes from biomass. We make ethanol fuels. People heat their homes with wood. The forest products industry powers itself on biomass. So a small percentage comes from the non-hydro renewables, and we do get some of our overall primary energy from biomass.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to the figure that you gave before, and I should have noted this down, that one of the things you had proposed is that within something like the next decade, you would have liked to see a doubling of the contribution of renewables.
The Clinton administration proposal was that the non-hydropower renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, and biomass, as a matter of electricity production,
right,
get to 7.5%.
Okay, so that's what I thought. So we would be talking. We'd still though be only talking about, in the total energy mix for electricity generation, only 7%. That seems like that's still not very much. How, if you think about long-term potential, say again, we just talked here about generating electricity, what do you think that it could be?
Well, one of the interesting pieces of work that's been done over the last few years has been done by one of the major oil companies, by Shell. And in one of their scenarios, and in fact in a variety of scenarios we've seen recently from energy companies, renewables figure very prominently as we move into the 2030, 2040, 2050 time frame. We could be looking worldwide at 30, 40, 50% of world energy coming from renewables. The thing I need to stress about these renewable energy sources is that they are relatively young technologies. You look back at 1980, not too long ago, there was virtually no wind power in the world. Just a tiny, tiny set of turbines spinning across the United States and the world generally. Fast forward to today, the price is now 90% less than it was in 1980, and it's now the fastest growing source of electricity in the world, wind power, providing electricity now for many millions of homes across across the planet. Compare that to nuclear power, for example. We've been at nuclear for 50 years in this country. Compare it to hydropower. The modern era of hydropower with the modern dams extends back almost to 1900. So it takes time, it takes money to move these kinds of energy technologies forward. Similarly, with natural gas, which is one of the newer sources of electricity in this country, it's at 15% of U.S. electricity now. Go back 20 or 30 years ago, and it was a tiny, tiny fraction. So these things do take time. Hmm.
For example, let's just talk a bit more about wind power. I would guess that to set up a wind farm, put up a bunch of wind turbines to generate electricity, would be cheaper than building a power plant, coal-fired or natural gas or nuclear or whatever. What is it that over this period of time has changed? Is it that we just learned better how to make better wind turbines, or what really has made the difference? As it seems to me, as a mechanical engineering challenge, that it wouldn't be all that complicated.
Well, when we started out in the 70s and early 80s, we had very primitive versions of wind turbines compared to what we have today. They were quite small. They, frankly, were quite unreliable, and the electricity they produced was quite expensive. You go forward to today, and a single modern wind turbine can produce enough electricity for 300 homes. It can operate for 20, 30, maybe even more years than that. And it can produce electricity at a cost that is now competitive in several parts of the country with the predominant new source of electricity in the United States, and that's from natural gas. So it is a combination of investment in the engineering side, much of that coming from government, and uptake in the market, which obviously lowers costs as well. As you build thousands and thousands of wind turbines every year and deploy them around the globe, prices come down.
This seems to be, this part of the country, the Midwest and also the West, seems to be prime candidate because we have a lot of open space where there's reliable wind, where the wind blows all the time. And what do you think about wind and where it is that it seems likely, if it's going to be an emerging energy source, where it's going to be?
Well, the heartland of the country, extending from the Dakotas south to Texas and going somewhat east and going somewhat west, is really a huge, huge opportunity for wind. We sometimes joke that North Dakota is the Saudi Arabia of wind and Texas is the Kuwait. Those two states together have a vast, vast wind potential, enough, in fact, to power a good chunk of the country. So there's plenty of wind. We are blessed with it, ironically. It is cursed by many farmers, but they're suddenly discovering that they can not only plant crops, but they can plant wind turbines and make a nice profit. A single turbine takes up a very small amount of ground. You can plant right up to the base of it, and farmers are today being paid $2,000 to $3,000 per year per turbine for the use of their land. 1,000-acre farm, you could have 30 or 40 turbines and still farm quite nicely. So it's a big opportunity. I have to say, one of the issues with it is, of course, transmitting the power. You've got to obviously have transmission lines in order to get access to this big wind resource. In Texas, they've been developing wind very rapidly. They have been able to tap into good transmission. In North Dakota and the other areas, South Dakota, Minnesota, Montana, other states, transmission is sometimes an issue. So in order to exploit this resource, we're going to have to potentially build some new transmission lines.
I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dan Riker. He's visiting fellow at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C., and before that, for a number of years, worked in the U.S. Department of Energy, most recently from 1997 until this year. He was Assistant Secretary of Energy for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. And if you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And indeed, we are talking this morning about sustainable energy sources and the place that they may have in the energy mix here in this country. We do have somebody here ready to go to talk with in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Just as an aside, when we consider sustainable sources, there's the storage problem, which is always kind of an issue. It's difficult to store the wind, which is something that fossil fuels bring us. But anyhow, I didn't want to get too heavily into that. How does the cost of conventionally generated power and conventional fuels affect and drive the development and the implementation of sustainable sources?
Good question. Let me first respond to your issue of storage. That's an important one. When the wind is not blowing or when the wind is blowing, you don't need the power, what do you do? One of the nice things about wind, for example, is that, in fact, you could, in an electricity system overall, you can blend it, as it were, with fossil sources. So, for example, the problem with wind is that it doesn't blow all the time. The fossil sources like natural gas obviously are always available. The problem with the fossil sources are that you can have serious price volatility. So by blending a source like wind, where the fuel is free but you've got intermittency problems, with a source like natural gas, where you can have the resource all the time but you've got price problems, you can get the best of both worlds. On to your issue of how the cost of traditional sources affects the cost of other sources, the sustainable sources. There's a healthy marketplace out there for energy, and the challenge for renewables has been to bring down their price so they can compete with sources of electricity, particularly the new sources like natural gas and some of the more traditional sources like coal and nuclear. And as, for example, we've seen price spikes with natural gas over the last couple of years, the price of natural gas going up, that has meant that sources of energy like wind and geothermal and biomass have been far more competitive. And so I think as people look at investments in new energy sources, they obviously try to project out into the future what people think the price of the traditional sources are going to be. The other element of that, of course, is trying to make predictions about the cost that new environmental requirements will impose on traditional sources. If, in fact, we move to regulate emissions of global warming gases, that obviously can have some impact on the price of fossil sources, making renewables all the more competitive. So you've got to look at where the technology is going, you've got to look at supply, you've got to look at environmental issues.
It's a very complicated subject, much more complicated than the treatment it receives in the media, I suspect.
Well, absolutely.
One of the really frustrating things is it would be better for alternative energy if fossil fuels and whatever you're trying to get rid of, if those costs skyrocketed, because it would really stimulate the development and the implementation of alternative sources. On the other hand, the people who provide these fuels, and I'm thinking of our friends in the Mideast, kind of deliberately manipulate the supply and demand situation to keep the price at an advantageous location for them. So if they see somebody conserving too much and they're not selling enough, what would they do?
Well, there is a sense that at a certain point where a traditional fuel like oil, for example, gets too high in price, obviously alternatives kick in much more readily. And so I think it's fairly clear that folks who control oil supplies are very cognizant of the development of alternative fuels, where they're headed, what their price points are, and do pay attention to that as they set oil prices. Interestingly, I would also add that some of the oil companies themselves see some big opportunities with renewable power and renewable fuels. British Petroleum now, for example, is has the largest solar company in the world. Shell is investing heavily in biomass. They know that to compete in this new century and to be able to deal with supply issues, price volatility, they've got to have a mix of energy sources as well. So I think that's probably a pretty good development.
I think the whole idea of having a mix is a thoroughly delightful approach. Just to return to the subject we started on, the person who invents a good battery so that you can store energy in a small area is going to be a gazillionaire.
Yeah, battery storage, that's also the beauty of the push that's being made, which I'm very supportive of right now, towards fuel cells which run on hydrogen ultimately being able to both transmit and store energy in the form of hydrogen and use it in the form of fuel cells.
Safely.
That's right.
Okay. Thank
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, here we're getting pretty close to the midpoint of the program. Our guest is Dan Riker. He's now a visiting fellow at the World Resources Institute, and before that, for a number of years, worked in the U.S. Department of Energy. We're talking about sustainable energy and its potential here in the country and around the world. And questions are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Just to underscore something you were talking about here with the caller, we would expect, even if today we started very aggressively to develop sustainable energy and we could get it and we maybe could get it to the point where it'd be half perhaps of the energy mix, that we would still expect for the foreseeable future that we would continue to burn oil and coal and natural gas?
Yes. Fossil fuels, coal, oil, natural gas today make up more than 80% of our energy. That sort of leads you to two very important points. First is making vastly more efficient use of these traditional sources. We, for example, in generating electricity from fossil and nuclear sources today, we throw away 2 out of every 3 units of energy we put into those plants. That is, they're only one-third efficient. And we throw that away as waste heat. It goes up cooling towers and down rivers. We know how to generate electricity much more efficiently than 30-plus percent, and we need to be doing it, and we are in many cases with some of the newer technology. Secondly, we need to use it more efficiently, the energy we produce, whether it's in our homes, our businesses, our cars, and we've got vast potential there. So making more efficient generation and use of traditional sources as we develop these new, more sustainable sources, I think is really the key to going forward. And I think while we're looking at relatively small percentages that renewables represent today, we are seeing fantastic growth. Just since 1997, for example, 100,000 new solar systems have gone on people's homes and businesses around the country. That's a technology that's really coming into its own. Still has to improve on the price side. It's still a relatively costly way to produce electricity. The solar hot water systems are more cost effective, but we're making great progress there. And I think if we continue to invest in the R&D, we provide some incentives as we do with traditional fuels, we take some other smart policy actions, we can really move this forward.
What sort of potential do you see for solar on the large scale? So say a large solar farm, the way that we were talking about large wind farms. So we would have a large space, have all these solar collectors, and then they could just soak up as much sun as they possibly could.
There is potential for that. There's so many different kinds of solar technologies. Some of them work well best in small distributed applications, you know, on people's roofs. There's others, the so-called solar dishes and solar troughs, which can collect large amounts of solar energy and produce electricity quite well, particularly in the southwestern part of the United States, for example. So solar's got a lot of very broad potential, very small applications to rather larger applications, more at the scale of a small to medium-sized main power plant. I have solar panels on my roof in Washington, D.C. that produce electricity. I put them up a couple of years ago. On many days, I'm making more power than I'm using, and I actually run my electricity meter backwards and sell the excess power to the local utility, get paid at a retail rate. I also made some investments in energy efficiency in my home, a better air conditioner, better refrigerator, better lights, windows, and I'm down to $1 a day for electricity now. So it can work. The technologies are here. If we continue to push them, I think they're going to gather steam. But we do need help from Washington. We do need help from the states, and we need the public to better understand the potential.
We have several callers. We'll take them in the order they came in, starting with Terre Haute. Here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, several years ago, there was two guys, I think it was with Stanford University, published a book on energy crisis. Do you recall that or remember who that, I think it was 1970 or somewhere around there.
Daniel Yergin?
I don't know. What I was trying to get to is they did probably the most thorough study of the energy crisis coming up to our country, mm-hmm. and even compensating with unheard of technology.
Right.
There was only one solution, and that was nuclear fusion. We should, instead of wasting our time on all these other renewable things, we should start in 1950 with a crash program in nuclear fusion, and we wouldn't have this problem. You have the ideal fuel in nuclear fusion. In fact, that would be the one way we could eliminate our huge stockpile of nuclear fusion waste now, which is a tremendous problem.
Yeah, let me say on that, there are two different kinds of nuclear technologies out there. There is the technology we use today all over the country to make electricity,
right.
And that's fission.
Yeah.
Nuclear fusion is essentially trying to replicate on Earth the process of that we see up in the sun.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And lots of money has been spent on it. It's still decades off. Work continues, but I do think it doesn't have the practical opportunities that many of the other traditional and alternative fuels have today.
I will confess that we do need some energy until that time comes. But I don't hear that much about any research being done.
Yeah, there's still research going on, for example, at Princeton, funded by the government, but it's been turning more and more into a pure research program and less into a program for practical application, just because there have been so many problems in actually harnessing this for everyday energy use. So I frankly don't see this as the sort of direction that makes sense, and I don't see a lot of support for it in Congress, for example, compared to other sources.
You know, there's one other source of energy that's available, and I thought they would. You ever heard of the Bay of Fundy?
Yeah, there's also tidal energy.
Use the tide.
Yeah, that's another source that's been explored. There are countries that use it, and there are some new concepts that are being looked at, both here in the U.S., for example, by the Navy, mm-hmm. and other research institutes, and then also internationally. I think there's some opportunity there. I don't see it, though, in the next decade or two.
Because the amount of money it would take, instead of wasting money on when you talk about these wind generators, I remember around San Francisco up on the hills, they had those big windmills there then. And we're talking, let's see, 40 years ago probably, easily. But they, like you said, they just can't compete money-wise.
Oh, they compete. Those old ones didn't compete well at all. It's the new ones that are going in very, very large quantities all across the country, and in fact, even more quickly in many other countries around the world. They do compete quite well. In fact, that's why just a couple of months ago, out in the West Coast, where they're desperate for power, the biggest order ever for wind energy, 1,000 megawatts, enough for 300,000 homes, was placed by the Bonneville Power Administration, a unit of the Department of Energy, because they realize there's very cost-effective power with very few environmental problems. And the other thing that's great about wind is that you can site these turbines very quickly. You can put up a wind farm that generates a lot of power in a year, whereas more traditional plants take a lot longer. Another source that's gaining a lot of favor is geothermal energy. This is energy that where you extract the heat from the earth and boil water, make steam, and turn a turbine. California today already gets 6% of its electricity from geothermal. It doesn't have the challenge that wind and solar does, which is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. Geothermal is available almost 100% of the time in most plants. And so that's another great source. The other one that I think is particularly important for the Midwest is, of course, biomass. We today can quite cost effectively make electricity using agricultural and forest crops and wastes. We can make chemicals to replace the petroleum that's normally used to make chemicals, so that's a good way of reducing our dependence on oil. And of course, we know how to make ethanol, as you do in the Midwest, from biomass. The great step beyond corn-based ethanol that has a lot of people excited right now is being able to make it from all sorts of other organic materials. For example, the rest of the corn plant or municipal solid waste, and there are plants now being built in the United States that will demonstrate that technology.
I'm going to jump in here. I appreciate the comments of the caller. We're really getting short on time, or at least we're getting into about our last 15 minutes, and I have a number of other folks who'd like to get in on the conversation, so I want to give them a chance, and we'll go next to a caller in Belgium. Line number one. Hello?
Yes. You mentioned efficiency. It seems to me the most important aspect of our power problem is if we improved our efficiency. If you look right out your window, no matter where you're sitting, you'll see enormous quantities of transmission lines that you said were such a problem because we can't transmit it from different places. But one of the substantial losses of electricity is in the transmission. If we could come up with a much better way of transmitting power from point A to point B, we would save an enormous amount of money.
And completely agree with the caller. We lose roughly somewhere in the order of 4 or 5% up to sometimes 10% of the electricity that starts at a power plant before it gets to the end user. And that's a big loss.
Especially when you're talking about the power plant only generates a third of the energy.
Exactly.
From the energy, so we've already lost 10% there of that little bit. So yeah. It becomes very substantial very quickly.
Yep, in an old plant, you first lose two-thirds of the energy, and then you lose another 5 or 10%. You're way down. So that's the bad news. The good news is there are some technologies, better wires, for example, that are being developed and some actually being used today that will allow you to send more power more efficiently. And then down the road, a lot of work is going into superconductivity. This is essentially technologies that would allow you to have almost no electricity losses over wire through superconducting technologies. And that is down the road, but in Detroit, for example, they're installing the first underground power cable using superconducting technology to demonstrate that that would work.
The other point I wanted to point out is in wind, there is a cost to wind, especially when you initially sight it. You must watch where our birds fly, because wind power plays real havoc on on migration rates and different things like that, because birds run into something like that and it just destroys them by the bunches.
Very good point. The unfortunate thing is that a couple of the early wind farms in California were incorrectly sited. They were actually sited in bird migration routes, in one case sited where there were hawks and eagles that spent a good deal of their time. The good news is that the modern siting of wind turbines takes bird migration very much into account, and there have been almost no bird problems at the more recent wind farms sited all across the United States, because essentially they keep them out of the migration routes. So the bird mortality has been extremely, extremely low in the modern installations.
I'm glad to hear they improved on that. Thank you very much.
All right, let's go to Peoria for someone else right here, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. When Carter was president, he had panels put on the White House. When Reagan got to be president, he had them all ripped out. Are you aware of that?
Absolutely. That's what happened. President Carter was making hot water using the sun, and President Reagan decided he didn't want to do that.
Right. Now, what's wrong with taking garbage? There's millions of tons of garbage that can be used to make gas. Why don't we do that?
In fact, we're beginning to do some of that. We've obviously been using garbage for a couple of decades to burn it and make electricity that way. But there are, in fact, more advanced technologies, as the call is indicating, which allows you to actually turn the garbage into something like natural gas that you can run a turbine and make electricity, a more efficient, cleaner way of using garbage. And as I mentioned earlier, we also now are beginning to see plants being built that can turn the organic part of garbage into ethanol. So we have an opportunity to take something that we normally have to pay to get rid of, garbage, and turn it into a useful fuel. So the technologies are developing, and I think the markets are developing. The decision in California, the decision yesterday regarding California to require the use of ethanol there, I think is going to mean that we're going to see significant new development of not only corn-based ethanol plants, but I think we're finally going to see new development of ethanol from all sorts of waste materials, and that's a big, important step.
My son built a new home, and he had geothermal put in about 3 years ago. It's quite expensive. It cost $15,000, but payback time is 7.5 years.
Yeah, there's another kind of geothermal that is catching on. I think there were 100,000 systems installed in the U.S. over the last year or two, and that is this is not digging deep down into the earth to get at hot geologic formations, but simply going down 6 or 8 feet where you have a constant temperature year-round of 55 or 60 degrees. So it helps you heat in the winter and cool in the summer, and this is a rapidly growing technology, and the costs are coming down.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's see where we'll go next. Talk with someone in Bloomington, Indiana. Line three. Hello.
Hi. When alternative energy takes over, is it going to be the existing energy companies, like the oil companies, the electric utilities? Are these existing energy companies going to evolve into alternative energy companies, or is it going to be brand new companies we never heard of that are going to develop these new technologies? For instance, you mentioned Detroit. In Detroit, they're installing superconducting transmission lines.
Yes.
Is it the established power companies that are installing those lines, or who's installing those lines?
It's Detroit Edison. I think Pirelli, the Italian company, is involved. There's a variety, and a very not so small anymore company called American Superconductor from Boston.
So there are some new companies, and the old established companies are just in a coalition with them, aren't they? They're kind of cooperating together, aren't they?
Absolutely. You have what I think is a fairly healthy mix of the big established companies that are reaching out to the small, innovative entrepreneurial companies. There are now, I read this morning actually, 750 companies directly or indirectly involved in fuel cell work in the United States. So you have all sorts of small companies jumping into this. You have a real explosion in venture capital that's been made available to these advanced energy technologies just over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
As venture capital has tanked in the internet world, it has picked up mightily on the energy technology side.
Well, now, you mentioned American Superconductor and Pirelli. Would you buy stock in those firms?
Oh, I don't know enough about either of them. I was prevented from doing so in the government, so I've not looked at them from that perspective. What I would say is that these energy companies, whether they're in solar or in fuel cells or they're in superconductivity, I think they offer some very interesting investment opportunities. And the proof is in the pudding. These people in the venture capital world, as I said, are pumping big money in there and beginning to see some nice returns.
Well, thanks a lot.
All right. We have about 8 minutes or so left in the program. Let me introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Dan Riker. He is currently visiting fellow at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. From 1997 until 2001, he served as Assistant Secretary of Energy for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the U.S. Department of Energy, and had some other posts in the DOE before that. Before that, he worked as a senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council. He also served as a staff member of President Carter's Commission on the Accident at Three Mile Island. And we're talking this morning about renewable, sustainable energy. We have some other folks, and we'll try to get at least a couple of people in before we run out of time in this first hour. Going next to a caller on the campus and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I had to get away from the radio for about 10 minutes. I'm not sure if you talked about this, but last night on the news, they were talking about how the EPA is requiring California to use ethanol.
Yes.
And I was just wondering, I have another question beyond this, but how you came down on that issue.
Well, that's a decision that EPA made the other day, and that is to require ethanol as a so-called oxygenate in gasoline. I'm not going to get into the back and forth on the policy side of that. I would say that the decision having been made now, what I said earlier on the call is that I think you're going to see some big growth in not only corn-based ethanol in the Midwest, but actually out in California. I think you're in other Western states, you're finally going to see the emergence of ethanol being produced from all sorts of waste products as well. And I think that's a good step forward. There's a hot debate about whether ethanol is the right thing to be blending into gasoline as a way to clean it up. It gets very complicated, and I don't think I'll get into it here.
Okay, well, the other question is harkens back to my reading of science fiction as a kid. And I haven't heard too much about it lately, so I thought maybe you've got an insight into it. But I recall people saying that it'd be possible to cover the moon, for example, with solar plates, collectors of some sort, and microwave the energy down to the Earth. And is that even plausible for the far future?
There's certainly been work done, I don't know how much recently, but years ago, looking at orbiting solar collectors that could beam the energy down to Earth. I don't believe that that's a direction that we will go anytime soon. I think we've got vast resources here on Earth that are easier to get at, and the renewable ones in particular are endless and just that, renewable. So I don't think while it may be worthwhile to spend a little bit of money on that kind of work, I don't think in the long haul that's where we're going to head. I would say, though, and this is very important, one of the reasons we have made advances in solar technology and in fuel cells is because of the space program. Fuel cells got their real modern push in the Gemini program, and as everybody knows, virtually all the satellites that are sent aloft these days have big solar panel arms sticking out that power them. And it was NASA, along with other government agencies in the private sector, that really moved both of these technologies forward.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. We're almost out of time. Real quick, though, maybe you can say a little bit more about the fuel cell. Now, people perhaps have heard about the idea. We've been talking about this as potential for powering vehicles, buses and cars, and also some people suggest that maybe that would be you could have a power plant for your house, essentially, and that this is technology that takes hydrogen, oxygen, puts it together, we get energy, byproduct is water, it's a clean fuel, and something that I know a lot of people in a lot of places around the world are really excited about. What potential do you see for the fuel cell?
I see a vast potential, David. It is a very simple technology, and you explained it well. No moving parts. The issue is how you bring the cost down, and the second issue is where you get the hydrogen. Mm-hmm. There, sometimes people have a misconception that somehow that you just put the hydrogen and oxygen together and you get this result. Well, you do, but the question is, what's the source of the hydrogen? For the near term, most of the applications that people are talking about, the source of the hydrogen will in fact be fossil fuels. In your house, it might be pulling the hydrogen out of natural gas that comes into your house. In your car, it might be gasoline. It might be other fossil fuels. Over the medium and longer term, the real promise, the real opportunity of fuel cells is to derive the hydrogen from renewable sources. So, for example, literally getting the hydrogen out of water, running electricity into the water and splitting it into hydrogen and oxygen, the electricity itself being made from wind and solar and hydropower. When people talk from time to time about the so-called hydrogen economy, you know, decades down the road, that's ultimately what they're talking about. Being able to produce hydrogen in a renewable fashion, pumping that hydrogen into a fuel cell, letting it mix with oxygen, and making electricity to run a vehicle or to run a home or business. Lots of money is being put into this fuel cell technology and into the hydrogen production and storage. The automobile companies are betting some money on this. The power companies are as well. So I think I'm very bullish about this, but it will happen along with the other renewable technologies, efficiency, and of course, continued reliance on the fossil fuels.
There, we got to leave it for this moment, but I'm sure on future programs we'll get back to some of these topics. And certainly, if there are certain things that folks who are listening would like to hear us discuss, we're open to those suggestions. For the moment, we want to say thanks to our guest, Dan Riker. He's visiting fellow at the World Resources Institute. Mr. Riker, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.